The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Violent crime continues to spike.
We've had this enormous increase in crime in our nation's big cities, which are all run by Democrats. And on the national level, they haven't talked about crime at all.
This comes as police departments see their numbers dwindle.
Chicago Police Department has lost close to 700 officers since 2019.
We'll also look at how the fear factor over COVID-19 continues.
I mean, I just had to turn down a family member's wedding because they were inviting 250 people. I can't do that.
And later, Admiral James Stavridis addresses a troubling issue amongst our military.
The nature and scope of the problem of sexual assault is so pernicious, and I think we need to move to an outside look at it.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. When defund the police became the rallying cry for the far left, traditional Democrats realized they had a problem on their hands. Progressives vote for Democratic candidates, and the party did not want to upset that constituency. At the same time, the swing vote center cares deeply about crime. It's a lose-lose situation for Democrats. As anyone with a rudimentary understanding of law and order could have predicted, cutting police numbers has led to a spike in crime in big cities from coast to coast. Democrats are again in a precarious position. If they crack down on crime and show support for the police, they risk losing their far-left base. If they don't, they risk losing everyone else. I discuss this dance with Byron York of the Washington Examiner and Fox News.
If you remember back in the last year of the David Dinkins administration, which was 1993. Many of your listeners may not remember that, but they can read about it. 1993. There were roughly 2,000 murders in New York.
Yep.
Rudy Giuliani is elected, and after 4 years, or 5 years, there are 600 murders in New York. Now, 600 may sound like a lot, but New York is a huge place, and he had literally cut the murder rate into less than a third of what it had been. And it kept going down through the subsequent years of Giuliani's time and through the two terms of Michael Bloomberg. And I think one of the questions for New York in electing Bill de Blasio was, do we continue with that progress that created public safety? Or, like the patient who takes his meds, feels better, and decides he doesn't need his meds, can we just stop and we'll go back to our old ways? So they went back to their old ways, electing de Blasio. So now they have this choice. The murder rate is still way, way, way below what it was when I talked about the end of the Dinkins administration. But crime is going up quite a bit. Public safety is the number one concern. And the question is, what are the voters going to do? Remember, when Giuliani ran for re-election, I believe in 1997, he got re-elected, although nobody voted for him. I mean, people they wouldn't come out and say, I'm going to vote for Giuliani, but they did, because they wanted the place to be safer. And it did two things. It created an incredible quality of life, because New York City is the greatest city in the world. It created an incredible quality of life for people who live there and for people who visited there. So New York has had this choice, because they're so blue. It has a choice. Does it give in to its progressive wing, or does it try to have a more common sense style of governments like Giuliani and Bloomberg had?
And this leads me to what Joe Biden is doing. He's going to talk about crime. What do you think that telegraphs?
Extraordinary. Let me say one more thing about the New York candidates. We did have this extraordinary moment a couple of days ago when Andrew Yang talked about homeless people and being harassed New Yorkers being harassed by mentally ill people. And this has been an argument for generations now, in which liberals basically wanted to deinstitutionalize people who actually needed to be institutionalized. You see, in any big city, you see people living on the street who are drunk, on drugs, or crazy, or both, who are just leading terrible lives. They need to be institutionalized to help them. It is not helping them to have them live under some cardboard on a street corner. And it's also, there have been quite a number of attacks on New Yorkers by, as Yang said, people who were mentally ill. So just have a candidate come out and say that in the Democratic race. And, of course, Yang got criticized for it. Was really extraordinary. So now, what's interesting about Biden is Democrats, we've had this enormous increase in crime in our nation's big cities, which are all run by Democrats. And on the national level, they haven't talked about crime at all. I mean, Joe Biden just doesn't want to talk about it. So the idea that he's even going to address it, I think, marks a major step forward for them. But the fact is, whenever crime is up, whenever public safety is an issue, it's the most important issue because it's the most fundamental. People are scared physically for their own safety and for their family's safety, and just for the nature of their community as a whole. If you have a dramatic increase in crime, then it becomes the most important issue.
When you look at the jarring violent crime numbers from big cities, it becomes even more clear that something must be done. Lives depend upon it. Here's Salem host Larry Elder.
New York City, the largest police agency in the country. NYPD is down 1,500 officers. Retirements jumped to 2,600 last year from 1,500 2 years earlier. Another nearly 350 officers.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Had left by mid-May this year. Last year, New York outlawed officers from using a knee on a suspect's back or chest. Many experts have criticized this law for criminalizing martial arts techniques routinely used by cops to safely subdue resisting suspects. That's New York City. Chicago. Chicago Police Department has lost close to 700 officers since 2019, according to data supplied by the Fraternal Order of Police for the Officers Union. 2019, the department was able to hire 464 officers. In 2020, that number dropped to 157. This year, 101 have been hired as of June 15. Meanwhile, 560 Chicago cops retired last year compared to 475 in 2019 and 339 the year before. This year so far, 360 have retired as of June 15. And it's not just old officers leaving. According to the Fraternal Order of Police, quote, "We have young officers doing lateral transfers, leaving this department and going somewhere else, whether it's a suburb or out of the state entirely. I'm talking the same people that wanted to pick up the mantle and carry on the police department are the ones who are leaving and saying that they have had enough." L.A. LAPD has lost nearly 600 officers since 2019, partly due to government hiring freeze that was implemented in response to the pandemic. But also the city decided to cut the LAPD budget by $150 million and redirect that towards childhood programs or programs for the black community. Defunding was supposed to cut the staffing level to 9,757 officers. As of right now, the department is down to 9,444 officers, or nearly 300 short. Meanwhile, the city of L.A. recorded more than 1,000 people shot fatally and non-fatally in 2020. That is an increase of 40% over 2019. And this year, so far, 626 people have been shot as of June 12th. That's a 60% increase from the same period year to year the year before. Meanwhile, in the Bay Area, there has been a shoplifting bonanza. As a result, Walgreens has closed 17 stores. The director of the Retail Crime Division at CVS told the New York Times that San Francisco is, quote, one of the epicenters of organized retail crime. And CVS employees have been instructed not to pursue thieves because, quote, the encounters had become too dangerous. We've had incidents where our security officers are assaulted on a pretty regular basis, end of quote. And again, the New York Times talks about the 2014 ballot initiative, which, quote, all but decriminalized looting. Folks stealing less than $950 in merchandise were reclassified as misdemeanors from nonviolent felony thefts. Police stopped busting them. They weren't worth the time and the effort. They're only going to be released and put right back on the streets. So this has emboldened stealing, especially at drugstore retail chains. Private companies looking to defend their stuff have been sued. Retailers have been taken to court by people they caught shoplifting. Thieves claimed that they were victims of racial profiling, according to a piece in the Washington Times. Quote, therefore, the real reason why many retailers won't crack down on their own stores is fear of negative publicity, close quote. Wall Street Journal writes, quote, some large retailers, including Goodwill, Walmart, and Bloomingdale's, sought to punish shoplifters by requiring them to take a class in life skills to avoid a criminal complaint. The San Francisco city attorney then sued the company that provided the classes for extortion and false imprisonment. I'm not making this up. Again, year to year, 45 officers killed in the line of duty. Last year, year to year, 31. Year to year, 45% increase in officers being assaulted, shot at, stabbed, or rammed with an automobile. 45% increase in instances like that. Now, why is this going on? What's causing it?
Coming up, The View's Joy Behar.
I mean, I just had to turn down a family member's wedding because they were inviting 250 people. I can't do that.
Lingering fears of COVID when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Nearly half the United States population is vaccinated. For those who are older, that number is 80%. Just about anybody in our country who chooses to be vaccinated is vaccinated or soon will be. And because of this, ballparks across America have opened up. Sporting events are seeing 50,000 plus fans in attendance. For many, life is back to normal in the state. But some simply aren't ready to go outside yet and get into the normal pre-pandemic rhythms of life. Here's Salem host Mike Gallagher.
The fear factor, we talked about it a lot. We've talked about it for a year or more. And all of us were susceptible to it, right? All of it. Look at Joy Behar. Still, people on the left seem to want to wallow in the fear forever. How long is this going to last? Here's cut eight. Here is Joy Behar on The View explaining she's not going to go to her own family member's wedding because they're going to have people there. This was yesterday on The View.
Joy, how about you? Do you have any concerns on your part about going outside?
No, I do have concerns about going into situations where there are mobs of people, and I will not go there. I mean, I just had to turn down a family member's wedding because they're inviting 250 people. I can't do that. But on the other hand, I'm following the science, and I've been double vaxxed, and every doctor on television, on this show and others, tells you that if you get the double vaccine, you're pretty good with the variant, that you're not going to get it. And so what more do people have to hear? We'll never leave the house if we're going to continuously be afraid to go out.
Well, you're not going to go to a loved one's wedding because they'll have 250 people there. Joy Behar won't leave the house to go to a family member's wedding, but she's double. What does double vaxxed means? Does she mean she's got two shots and double vax is better than the single vax, I guess, because two masks are better than one? These people are crazy. She's not following any science. You're vaccinated. Go to your loved one's wedding. The heck's wrong with you? Well, we know the answer. She's a loony leftist. And loony leftists want to wallow in fear. They love the fear. They love the anxiety. I'm a New Yorker. Fear's my life, says the famous line from, I think, Rent. It's absolutely true. People on the left love to live in fear. You consider Joy Behar's remarks. She's double vaccinated. But at some point, people like Joy Behar have got to get over themselves. At some point, they got to drop the fear, and I don't know that they ever will. I hear people talking on different radio shows. They're never leaving the house. They're never going to leave. They're going to hunker down. Because you know people who like being miserable? We all know people like this. They enjoy being miserable.
Earlier this week, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin agreed that sexual assaults in the military is a problem that may have to be addressed outside the military justice system. Many say it is an epidemic that requires aggressive action. Prior to that decision, retired United States Navy Admiral James Stavridis joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show to discuss the problem. What is the general situation in the military about this? And is this a problem that is recent or just recently recognized?
It is the latter, recently recognized. If you look back at our history, it's not good. And it's certainly not suddenly shifted. You can't point to a pivot and say, gosh, this is where the problem really began. It's a leadership problem, a challenge. We've got to confront it head on. And the way to do that is by constantly surfacing these cases, discussing them. And above all, it's listening to the soldiers when they come forward with their allegations, taking them seriously and having the chain of command dive into them. There's no magic here, and we have a problem, and we cannot continue to have this problem because we'd say in the Navy, these are our shipmates. These are the women we work alongside, and of course, men are vulnerable to rape as well. We've got to get this fixed.
Now, is this one of those problems that if the leadership of a unit, a base, a ship raises it, It hurts the leader as much as it hurts the victim in terms of career. But are there reasons why commanders don't want to come forward? Does it hurt their careers to surface the issue?
I don't think it does. And I have never seen a case personally in my long years in the service where a commander was disciplined for bringing forward significant problems of this nature in his or her command. So I don't think that's the genesis of the problem. I think you put your finger on it, Hugh. It's a combination of young people who don't want to bring the problem forward when it occurs, when they're a victim, because they're unsure of how the treatment of the case will come out. And secondly, the military chain of command has fumbled these cases in many cases. Sometimes they've handled them well, but sometimes they fumbled them and badly. And I think that personally, that the current push toward taking these kind of cases out of the traditional chain of command and putting them over on the side of the JAG Corps, our judicial branch, makes a lot of sense for exactly the reasons you described.
Now, when did that start? When did they start shifting to a separate pipe?
They haven't yet. At the moment, if a sexual case is brought forward, it is adjudicated like any other case, like theft or any other miscreant behavior is adjudicated by the straight chain of command. On a ship, you go to sailor, to chief petty officer, to department head, to executive officer, to commanding officer, to commodore, et cetera. All the same in the services. What is under discussion for sexual abuse cases is if an allegation comes forward, instead of letting that chain of command investigate it, you have outside investigators come in, and they would come in from the JAG Corps, the Judge Advocate General's Corps, and then the case would go to a trial court convened outside the chain of command. It's a controversial idea, and the idea has been around for about a decade. It's been pushed hard by some on the Hill. It's taken me a while to come around to agreeing with it, but I am now at that point. I noticed that our current Secretary of Defense, General Lloyd Austin, is wrestling with this decision right now. And by press reports, I haven't talked to Lloyd about it, by press reports, he is leaning in favor of moving it out of the chain of command.
And why would people resist that? There's got to be an argument on both sides with that, Admiral.
Yeah.
So what's the both sides argument for a civilian audience?
It is that in the military, you want unity of chain of command because this is a group of men and women who have to go into combat. They have to be ready to respond at life and death situations. And therefore, for unit cohesion, you want the chain of command to be seen as the source of discipline and guidance. And when you introduce an outside look at a problem, it undermines confidence of junior sailors and soldiers in that chain of command. And I've wrestled with this. I think that the nature and scope of the problem of sexual assault is so pernicious, and we don't seem to be solving it using the traditional chain of command. I think we need to move to an outside look at it, as again, I think this is where this is headed.
Coming up, the Supreme Court sends an unmistakable message that they support religious liberty.
I think this is a message to politicians. It's a message to state and local officials. It's a message to lower courts that you have to stop discriminating against religious organizations that uphold the belief that marriage is between one man and one woman.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. In Fulton v. City of Philadelphia, the Supreme Court sent a clear and unequivocal message to progressives that they can no longer target religious traditionalists in their selective exclusionary processes. It was also a message to conservatives that responsible constitutionalists are leading the nation's high court. In a 9-0 decision, the justices ruled in favor of Catholic Foster Care Agency, a subdivision of the Diocese of Philadelphia, against the city of Philadelphia, because Philadelphia discriminated against the diocese and the agency on account of their religious beliefs. The city sought to discriminate against the Catholic diocese because of the central tenets of the Catholic faith. The diocese would only have its foster care agencies place children in homes parented by a married heterosexual couple. The city disagreed and exiled the diocese from the business of placing foster care children. The diocese win was a big win for the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. I discussed the outcome with John Birch of the Alliance Defending Freedom. Now, I wrote a Washington Post column about how the Fulton case is a huge win, 9-0 for religious liberty. Will you tell people what the holding is and what the opinions telegraph going forward?
You bet. It's unusual to see a unanimous Supreme Court opinion, especially in the area of religious liberty, but this one deserves it. This involves Catholic Social Services and their foster agency in the city of Philadelphia. They did a great job serving kids. And in a city that needs placements for thousands of kids who don't have homes right now, their support was critically important. And the city of Philadelphia terminated them as a provider, as well as any other religious provider, that held the view that marriage was between man and one woman. And the U.S. Supreme Court rebuked the city of Philadelphia and said that terminating Catholic Social Services was unconstitutional and a violation of the Free Exercise Clause. What they did is they put kids first, because every child in need of a forever home deserves the chance to be adopted or cared for by a foster family. And allowing faith-based adoption and foster care agencies to operate in the city will certainly do that.
Now, John, you've argued 12 Supreme Court cases. You know how hard it is to get an 9-0. I have been analyzing the Chief Justice's majority opinion. Some conservatives are grinding their teeth, as I point out in the Washington Post, because they wanted Smith overruled. I want Smith overruled as well. It's clear to me it's going to be overruled. They just have to work through the case on which to overrule it and the test that they replace it with. Justices Barrett and Kavanaugh, joined by Breyer, pretty much telegraphed that. Do you read it the same way I do?
I do read it exactly the same way. At least five justices said that Smith has to be overruled, and it should, because Smith is an opinion that takes the teeth out of the Free Exercise Clause and says that so long as you have a law which is neutral and generally applicable, then it can infringe on religious liberty, which we all understand can't possibly be right. But I do think it's going to take the right case, and it's going to take a little work from those who fight these types of litigation matters to ensure that there's a test that the justices are comfortable with. But I'm confident that we can get there.
I am also, now I'm reading the mind of a guy I've known for a long time, and I'm not friends with the Chief Justice, I'm friendly with him. I think he wanted 9-0 more than he wanted Smith to be jettisoned. He wanted a 9-0 message to the country, and especially to the administrative state, that if they have an exemption power at all, that is going to go by the wayside. We're done with Trinity Lutherans, we're done with playgrounds that can't be subsidized by the state if they're a Catholic school or a Lutheran school. We're done with everything that carves out an exception that does not apply to religion. So, John, I think it's actually kind of sweeping. And if you don't get the message now, you've got to be deaf, dumb, blind, mute, and indifferent to the law.
Completely agree with that. I think this is a message to politicians. It's a message to state and local officials. It's a message to lower courts that you have to stop discriminating against religious organizations that uphold the belief that marriage is between one man and one woman. The Supreme Court has said that repeatedly. They said that in the Obergefell decision, even as they were recognizing a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, which incidentally isn't in the Constitution. They said it again in Masterpiece Cake Shop involving Jack Phillips, and now they've said it again here, that people may have differences on marriage, but you cannot punish those who believe that marriage is between one man and one woman. Constitution says that's off-limits.
Now, John Birch, if you were the persecutors of Jack Phillips in Masterpiece Cake Shop, it's happening again. Some people wanted him to make a cake celebrating a transgender transition. And he said, no, that's against my religion. So he got fined again by the Denver court or by the civil authorities in Colorado. It's like the dumbest. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. They're going to lose again. Do you think they'll take a look at 9-0 and say maybe we'd better leave Jack Phillips alone?
Well, I sure hope so, because we'll take it back to the U.S. Supreme Court if we have to again. This latest decision against Jack with respect to the gender transition case came down just days before the unanimous Supreme Court decision in Fulton, the one that we've been talking about. And so I'm hopeful that the Colorado Court of Appeals will look at that unanimous decision and take notice. It's ridiculous that they continue to persecute him because of his religious beliefs.
To hear the rest of the conversation, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, Joe Biden gets lectured by communist leaders.
And so when you go on these apology tours and you continually castigate your own culture and society, then you don't have any moral authority.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. In the run-up to his meeting with President Joe Biden, Russian President Vladimir Putin accused the United States of being hypocrites in their criticism of Russian brutality. In a climate where Democrats regularly accuse their own country of such things as systemic racism, it's difficult for Biden to fight back against Putin's allegations. Salem host Sebastian Gorka spoke with historian and prolific author Victor Davis Hanson. They begin with a look back at Hillary Clinton's accusation that Putin did not want her to defeat Donald Trump.
How indicative of a broader opinion, former Senator Clinton, that Russia tried to deny her the presidency? Is that one crazy opinion, or could it be worse than that?
Oh, I'm afraid, Sebastian, it's much worse. Everything she said was completely untrue. You got to remember that right after Obama was inaugurated, she went on a tirade that George Bush had appeased the Russians in South Ossetia by his meager sanctions. And that was he had appeased them, but they were going to reset with Russia. And she got this little jacuzzi button in Geneva and pushed it, mistranslated the word for reset. And then she said that actually Bush had been too mean to Putin, and that she was going to open up this window, and that no more sanctions, no more lectures to Putin. He was going to be a part strategic partner. And then remember in 2011 in Seoul, Barack Obama said that he was willing to give up some security, missile security with the Eastern Europeans if Putin gave him space during his reelection bid in 2012. And I need no need to say that John Kerry invited Vladimir Putin into the Middle East after 30 years of a hiatus. So they appeased him, and the result was, as soon as Obama got elected, Putin went on a tirade in 2014. He went into Crimea, he went into Ukraine, and the only person ever stood up with him to him was Donald J. Trump. Donald Trump increased the sanctions. He flooded the world with cheap oil that hurt Russia. He killed 200 mercenaries. He got out of that asymmetrical short-term missile deal, and he jawboned Russia. And already Biden has approved the pipeline. He hasn't done anything about hacking. What does he mean that he's learned a lot about Putin? All he's learned about is how to be afraid. Putin's a Machiavellian, satanic, but brilliant interlocutor. And when he said the other day that, look at the people at the Capitol, they were political protesters. Your law enforcement killed one person. He was doing what the Chinese did before by blaming racism, American racism, for tying the lab to the origins. And the left, of course, loved that. And now they can't say a thing when Putin mimics that same tactic.
How effective is it when somebody like that, a former KGB colonel, brings up Black Lives Matter and rioting in America after the first summit meeting with the new head of state in the United States?
Well, he has no apprehensions. He has no fears. And it is very effective, because what he's basically saying is, you people lecture me, but I'm not going to lecture you. I'm just going to play back what you say about yourself. And so when you go on these apology tours and you continually castigate your own culture and society, then you don't have any moral authority to say you have to do this or you did that or you're authoritarian or you did this to the Uyghurs. So these leaders in China and Russia are saying to us, okay, you know, some hackers took out a pipeline and wow, some hackers also were interrupting meat supplies. But you guys said that meat was bad for you in the first place and you said you were going to get off fossil fuels and 15 years. So all we're doing is expediting your own agenda. So when we do this, we open ourselves out to very effective propaganda.
And how intriguing is it, if you're following geopolitical trend lines, to see that this is actually a pattern, to see in the first China-U.S. summit in Anchorage, already the chief communist diplomat used the talking points from the left wing here, throwing BLM and riots in the face of Antony Blinken, the cabinet-level diplomat. The idea that communist China and the Russian Federation are using domestic talking points together, you are the master historian on strategy on ancient Greece and so forth. Doesn't that potentially presage action when dictatorial or authoritarian regimes use that kind of language? They're not just talking, are they?
No, they're not. I mean, Khrushchev beat up Kennedy in the first summit. And guess what? Yeah. A little over a year later, he went right into Cuba. And guess what? Dean Acheson told the world that South Korea wasn't in our realm of defensive responsibilities. And guess what? A few months later, the North crossed the DMZ, the 38th parallel. So same thing with April Glaspie. She said to Saddam Hussein, it's not our interest to
Kuwait.
interfere in internecine Arab squabbles. And then guess what? He went into Kuwait. So they were testing us in Alaska. Putin studied that Chinese-American mini-summit, and he understands that Biden is weak. And if you want to have a territorial expansion or some type of advancement or gain of interest, he thinks, and the Chinese think this is the time to do it. Doesn't mean they'll do it, because there's other interests that they have to consider, but they feel that it's less likely now that the United States would muscularly respond to an aggression on their part. And that's dangerous, because deterrence depends on the enemy knowing exactly your capability, but not knowing exactly when you may strike. But when you cut the defense budget and you broadcast that you're fine with selling them, helping with the pipeline, or you're castigating your own country, or you're not doing anything about hacking, then you are saying to them, we're going to be predictably docile, but we're also going to cut back and use our savings to help the homeless and other things that the left has proposed in the defense savings.
And not only that, when the G7 prior to the NATO summit, prior to the Russia-U.S. summit, when their focus or what they message to the world, Professor Hansen, is, well, we need a universal corporate tax for our nations. We need to focus on climate change. How does China and how does the Kremlin look at that?
Well, they're delighted. They're saying, well, wait a minute, you're going to take this big hit in your economy and go over to unreliables and expensive, quote unquote, renewable fuels while we're going to pump gas and burn coal? That's fine with us.
Coming up, cake maker Jack Phillips is targeted once again with a controversial cake request.
It was to celebrate a gender transition.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, a big year for decisions coming out of the Supreme Court, including a 9-0 decision bolstering religious liberty.
When cities and governments have this kind of broad discretion, they can't use that discretion in a way that punishes religious people.
Albert Mohler brings analysis on what it means and why it matters.
It sends the signal that cities, states, had better be very careful about directly contradicting religious liberty.
The IRS denies a Christian group tax-exempt status
because of its biblical teachings.
Plus, Jack Phillips, the cake maker, is back in court.
What we have here is really an incident of harassment and targeting.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Colorado cake maker Jack Phillips has been targeted repeatedly by left-wing groups in Colorado who simply want to destroy his business. There are many places that they can get cakes they want exactly as they want them, and they know that. Phillips does not himself target the LGBT community, and they also know that. Out of his deeply held core convictions, his religious beliefs, he simply can't make specialized cakes to celebrate something which he disagrees with on religious grounds. He spoke to Dennis Prager about the latest attack.
So let's begin. The first issue that arose was it a gay wedding?
Yeah, two men came in asking me to create a cake to celebrate a same-sex wedding. Tried to tell them in just a couple of seconds before they flipped me off, swore at me, and flew out of my store. I wanted to explain to them that it's a cake that I couldn't create because a wedding cake has an inherent message, that I couldn't celebrate that, but that I'd be glad to sell them anything else in my shop or do other custom work. But that was the first cake, yeah.
Is that the one that went to the Supreme Court?
That is. And then that was argued December of 2017, and then June of 2018, they released their 7-2 favorable opinion in our favor and rebuked at the same time the Colorado Civil Rights Commission because of their open hostility towards me and my faith and their unequal treatment of other cake shops.
So what's the next story? You just lost another case, correct?
Correct. The day that the Supreme Court granted our case was a crazy, chaotic day. Lots of phone calls, media, press. I had a call for somebody requesting 38 wedding cakes to be delivered to 38 states. But I also had a call that day from somebody who called and requested a cake that was blue on the outside and pink on the inside. It was to celebrate a gender transition. And so we tried to explain to this person also that we would sell other custom cakes to them. You know, come in this shop, you can buy anything here. We treat you the same as anybody else, but that's a cake. It expresses a message that I can't create for you. That person took us to court through the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. The commission took up the case 3 weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in our first case, even though the Supreme Court rebuked the commission, like I said. But then that case was dismissed. So the person who requested the cake is now suing me in civil court. And that's the decision that came down yesterday.
Really? That's interesting. Oh, it's a civil suit.
Yeah, it's the same cake, same thing. We went through mediation, and during the mediation, the attorney said that, you know, if you win this case or if it's dismissed for any reason, I'll call you the next day with another cake and we'll start all over again, and then swore to that in court.
For more of that conversation between Prager and Phillips, go to townhallreview.com. Thank you for joining us on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Pochon, Michael Cook, Ben Brigman, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Harley Eide, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.